I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Episcopal Church in downtown Gainesville, Florida, is holding an interfaith service today. A nearby Methodist church plans a unity service on Friday as people in Gainesville react to the fact that much of the world is waiting to see what Pastor Terry Jones of the 50-member Dove World Outreach Center in Gainesville will do. He's, of course, threatened to burn at least one Koran on Saturday, 9/11, something the top U.S. commander in Afghanistan says will put U.S. troops in harm's way. Jackie Levine is managing editor for the local daily, the Gainesville Sun. And Jackie, your city has about 125,000 residents. You've got the University of Florida there. What are people in Gainesville thinking?
People here are a combination of, I would say, frustrated and embarrassed. I think they're frustrated because this is something that represents this one very, very small church. And I appreciate you saying the size of the church, because on any given Sunday, it may be between 30 and 50 people.
Well, and people may be embarrassed, but there are also some pretty big concerns this weekend. What are they?
Absolutely. The University of Florida is the flagship university in the state of Florida and has about 60,000 students. And you may have heard of the football team,
sure.
Pretty well known.
Theaters.
And on any given home game, there's something like 90,000 people who pack the stadium. Well, this just happens to be a home game. So we will have lots of visitors to Gainesville, lots of people in the stadium. So on any home game Saturday, there are security concerns. In this case, though, it's even worse. We have concerns about who's on their way. I mean, what could happen? Could anyone get hurt? And it's really frightening. You know, going back to the part about being embarrassed, I think people feel very bad that this is reflecting on the community in the way it does.
Well, the community is somewhat progressive. The mayor is openly gay. In fact, he's also been attacked by Pastor Terry Jones. But I'm just wondering, this is also being characterized in other media as something that's universally reviled, the idea of burning Korans. But we have talk radio here in Boston saying this is freedom of speech. I heard someone say last night, Muslims can attack us. Why can't we do this? Not, of course, differentiating between moderate and extreme Muslims. So are there some people there in Gainesville saying these kinds of things?
You know, they're not saying them overtly. I did get an email because I was on the BBC yesterday, and someone emailed me writing about, you know, her experiences being married to a fundamentalist Muslim, and saying, why isn't anyone outraged about what goes on under Sharia law and the woman getting stoned in Iran? My response to her was, no one is saying they're not appalled by that, but one thing doesn't justify the other, and that really doesn't have any place in this conversation. And people here are not coming out and agreeing with Terry Jones.
Question, though, is what he is now praying on today, whether or not he's going to do, is it illegal, either as a hate crime or as a simple municipal question? Does he need a permit from the fire department, for instance, to stand outside and burn things?
He does, and he has been denied a permit, so he will be violating the law, but the penalty for that is a fine. It's something I imagine he's just willing to risk.
Well, and the city has another concern, I'm sure. It's been reported that Pastor Terry Jones has received death threats, so as frustrated as city officials might be with him, do they also have to protect him?
Absolutely. They're going to have to protect him. Now, in today's paper, we have a picture of him walking his dogs in the nearby neighborhood, so he doesn't seem altogether concerned about it. Also, there have been pictures of him in his office flaunting his gun on his desk, so I imagine he thinks he's going to be able to protect himself. He also is said in response to questions about how do you feel about endangering American troops, as General Petraeus said, he said, you know, that he's willing to die for his beliefs. Didn't really answer the question about anyone else dying for his beliefs. But yes, the city of Gainesville, the police department, the sheriff will have to protect him.
And we understand there are about 1,500 Muslims in the area, some of them students. Is there any special concern about them? Have officials spoken to them directly?
Well, you know, I'm not sure if they've spoken to them directly, but I'll tell you it's very touching, because what many of these students have decided to do is on that day go downtown and feed the homeless and use this as a time to do some good works to contrast what will be going on at Terry Jones's church.
Jackie Levine, managing editor for the Gainesville, Florida local daily, the Gainesville Sun. Jackie, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Pastor Jones also has a link at his website to another site claiming that Barack Obama is a Muslim. Why do people believe that? Don't they remember the very public dust-up about Obama's Christian minister? Why do people still believe that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq when the CIA's DOFA report proved there weren't? Well, according to recent research, facts often not only don't correct misperceptions, they may actually harden them. Brendan Nyhan is a political scientist at the University of Michigan. In 2005 and 6, he presented research subjects with mock news reports with these kinds of false claims. Then, as newspapers do, he showed them corrections, and people didn't believe them. And Brendan joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
And you started noticing this phenomenon, we understand, when you worked for an organization that did fact-checking. What did you notice?
That's right. I was a co-editor of a website called Spinsanity, and our goal was to correct misleading political rhetoric. And what we found as we were doing our work is that it was very difficult to convince even our most dedicated readers that the side they favored was wrong. So even people who'd gone to the trouble of seeking out a fact-checking website disliked about half of what we wrote. And that got me thinking about, why is it so difficult to convince people that they're wrong? And is it possible for the media to correct those misperceptions?
And now you're a political scientist at the University of Michigan, and now you decide to do some studies. And let's be clear, these were informed people, but misinformed.
That's right. The paradox of misinformation is that it's often the most knowledgeable and sophisticated people who are best able to defend the beliefs that they want to defend. And that makes it hard to correct them when they are wrong.
Okay, well, let's set up some of your experiments. You decided to present participants in the study with news reports that had real quotes, but they were false information and false news reports that you had set up. So just so that people don't think that all of the misinformation comes from the right end of the political spectrum, because we just outlined some. You did one that involved a misperception on the left. These were real quotes from then-presidential candidates John Kerry and John Edwards in 2004, claiming that President Bush would put an end to stem cell research.
Well, that's right. So it was a mock news article in which Kerry and Edwards suggested that President Bush had banned stem cell research in this country. What Bush had actually done was limit federal funding of stem cell research to a certain number of stem cell lines. So any research with private funding could proceed, and there was federal funding available for research on those lines that existed before his initial decision. So this was a misleading claim. It was something that Kerry and Edwards said during the 2004 campaign, and we wanted to see how people would react.
In the correction you write, experts point out that Bush's action does not limit private funding of stem cell research. He's actually the first president to allow the use of federal funds to study human embryonic stem cells, but his policy limits federal support of such research to colonies derived from embryos already destroyed by August 2001. So you really put the facts there. How did people respond?
Well, what we found is that the people who were most inclined to believe Kerry and Edwards, which in this case were liberals, were unaffected by the correction. So their belief in the existence of a ban on stem cell research in this country did not change as a result of the correction. So it failed.
All right. So let's go on to two other experiments. In another false article, but with real quotes, you talked about President Bush maintaining that the war in Iraq was the right thing to do, because there was a real risk that Saddam Hussein would pass weapons on. In other words, that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction.
So again, the idea was to give people a mock news article with a misleading quote that, might, while technically true, might suggest that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction immediately before the U.S. invasion, and then to test what the effect of a correction was. And what we found in our first experiment was both surprising and depressing. The correction not only failed for the group that in this case was most likely to hold a misperception, but it actually made the misperception worse. This is what we call a backfire effect.
Tell us more about the backfire effect, that people even-handed information, and by the way, the correction on the WMD experiments were that there was a CIA report in 2003 authored by Charles Dulfer, we all know about it, that in fact there were no weapons of mass destruction, that Saddam Hussein had made a decision sometime in the 1990s to destroy any stockpiles. And yet, that what? How could you tell that that made people believe even more that there were weapons of mass destruction?
What we did is we asked them, do you agree or disagree with the following statement? And we provided them with a claim that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction and weapons of mass destruction programs immediately before the U.S. invasion. that's a 7-point scale. And so what we found was precisely that the conservatives who had been exposed to the correction moved up that scale relative to those who had not.
Right. They believed it even more. Why does that happen?
What we think is going on, and this is a claim that's consistent with other research, is that people are threatened when they're presented with information that suggests that they're wrong about something. So when we hear that information that says we're wrong, we try to justify that initial belief that's been called into question. And the process of doing that, which we call counter-arguing, you can actually end up convincing yourself even more strongly of why you thought that misperception in the first place. So to give you an example, in the case of Iraq, you're told Iraq didn't have weapons of mass destruction. You think of all the reasons you thought that. You think of, well, I heard this on talk radio, and my friend told me this, and I saw this on the news. And as you bring all those things to mind, you can actually end up overshooting in the opposite direction.
And that brings us to something else. If there's a climate of fear, which of course there was post 9/11, but also if someone has self-esteem issues, people who didn't feel that good about themselves were more likely to cling to beliefs.
That's right. There's a very interesting line of research in social psychology that people are threatened by information that contradicts what they already believe. And you can actually alleviate that discomfort by making them feel better about themselves. So my co-author, Jason Reifler, and I have tested that. What we did is we gave people a short essay task in which they were asked to write about a time in which they upheld a value that was important to them. And that's been shown to make people feel better about themselves. And then we gave them a graph of U.S. casualties in Iraq over time. And what we wanted to see was, did feeling better about yourself change how you reacted to that information? Because there are a lot of different ways you could interpret that information. You could, if you look at it, that you see a peak before the troop surge in Iraq and then a decline. So you could look at that and say the troop surge was a success in the case of liberals who might be more open. You could also look at that and say, wow, we've been in Iraq a long time and a lot of Americans have died fighting there. And what we found is that the liberals did not change their views, but that conservatives became more open to anti-war views, having been, or Republicans rather, as a result of being exposed to this task that made them feel better.
Well, there was one last one we want to talk about. This regards the Bush tax cuts and a claim that the tax cuts added revenue to the Treasury, you know, even though the government obviously took in less revenue from taxes. So set up the article and then the correction.
A common refrain from the Bush administration was the suggestion that tax cuts would increase revenue. And what we found was, again, a backfire effect. The conservatives who were exposed to the corrective information moved in what we would consider to be the wrong direction, believing even more strongly that tax cuts increase revenue.
And the correction, by the way, outlined indisputable facts about how revenue in the Treasury had actually gone down.
That's right. Numerous economists from the Bush administration have stated very clearly that they do not believe that tax cuts increase revenue. So even the administration's own economists don't agree with the suggestion.
That's political scientist Brendan Nyhan. By the way, in his study, he says while liberals held on to false beliefs, only conservatives hardened false beliefs when shown facts. But he concludes with more studies, liberals might demonstrate the same hardening. So what to do if this is all true? More with Brendan Nyhan after a break, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. On the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're talking with University of Michigan political scientist Brendan Nyhan about research he and a colleague did in 2005 and 2006 that showed that facts not only don't change people's minds, they may actually harden false beliefs. Brendan concludes that the only thing to do is be vigilant about people who spread those false beliefs. And this past weekend, we feel we may have seen an example of that on NBC's Meet the Press. Rich Lowry, the editor of the conservative magazine The National Review, was on the press roundtable. He said the stimulus has not worked. Now, this was even though just days earlier, the Independent Congressional Budget Office released a report saying unemployment numbers would be far worse without the stimulus. Well, Lowry's incorrect comment wasn't challenged until CNBC anchor Aaron Burnett spoke up.
By the way, I don't think the stimulus has been a failure. And I think that you are correct that it is perceived that way. But I don't think it's actually true. Without that stimulus, we would be significantly worse off than we are right now. There's really no question about it. You can ask any economist on Wall Street or any CEO. I see you shaking your head. I know you disagree, but my reporting would show otherwise.
Keep going.
A moment from this past weekend's Meet the Press, a moment Brendan Nyhan would like to see more of. But before we get to your conclusions, Brendan, tell us more about your research into misperceptions. Now, in your work, you wrote up mock newspaper articles using real quotes from politicians who made false claims. Then you gave people corrected information, which told them what was really true. But you cite another study on misperceptions, and this study was about welfare. It was from James Kuklinski of the University of Illinois. In the study, people in Illinois were asked how much the government spent on welfare, how many blacks were on welfare. Respondents' answers were wildly overblown. Only 3% even came close to the real numbers. But when researchers gave these people corrective information through personal contact, it seemed far more valuable than reading that correction in, mock newspapers the way you did it.
Well, that's right. It was by phone, but it was this interpersonal exchange. So people were asked to guess how much of the federal budget, I believe, was spent on welfare, and they gave a number, and then they were directly corrected by this phone interviewer. And that did have an effect on their views about welfare. So reading these facts that had been created by an expert panel had previously been found to have no effect, but this direct correction by a phone interviewer did.
Well, what does that say about media?
It's very hard. My bottom line on this is that the media is much less powerful than most people think. In terms of changing people's views, it's very, very difficult. And so if we want to fight misperceptions, once they're out there in the public, it's very difficult for the media to stop them.
Because people have started to, select their media and believe what they read in their media. So it's not likely that you might even see a correction. But if you do see it, for instance, in a paper that you dismiss, you're not going to believe it.
That's right. And that's the reason that I've argued that we should be more aggressive in criticizing the elites who promote misinformation.
You're using the word elites. You mean who?
I mean the people who have access to the big megaphones of media. So the pundits.
Right and left.
The opinion writers, absolutely, right and left. Whether it's on MSNBC, Fox, talk radio, bloggers, columnists, the people who misuse those positions of power and authority to mislead people. Many of these discussions about, for instance, the Obama Muslim myth have failed to mention at all the role of elites in promoting the suggestion that he might be a Muslim. So we need to be more aggressive in identifying these elites, and we need to be more aggressive in not giving them access to that megaphone in the future. This isn't a question of freedom of speech or censorship. It's a question of media outlets taking responsibility for the content that goes out over their airwaves, on their websites, etc.
I'm hearing you, and I'm thinking all sorts of cliches. They include that horse has left the barn. Do you really think there's a way to change this sort of hardened polarization? When you read this research that you've done, it would seem that if media elites or people with a megaphone, or whatever you want to call them, have also seen this research, they know they can say whatever they want and it won't matter because facts won't get in the way.
I suspect that's true.
You're nodding, yeah.
I suspect that's true. And it's very difficult. We live in a polarized society, so the audience for these sorts of claims is quite large, and you can make a very good living pandering to those people. And in fact, there's some evidence that the primetime lineup of MSNBC is moving in that direction and is going to end up being quite a direct counterweight to Fox.
And their supporters would say maybe someone has to counter some of the misperceptions we just talked about, most of which have been from the right. Although, I should add, you also looked, for instance, into a claim by liberal Michael Moore that the war in Afghanistan was waged to build a lucrative gas pipeline. You found that claim to be completely unfounded. But actually, let's just stay there for a second with what I just did. Admittedly, having a feeling that I had to balance misinformation from one side by pointing out a claim against the other side of the political spectrum. And you say that trying to find that sort of moral equivalence can be counterproductive.
It can be a bad style of reporting when it prevents us from saying what's true and what's false. Fairness has to take a backseat to truth. And depending on the issue, that may go both ways. On my blog, when I write about politics, I'll call out a liberal misperception, I'll call out a conservative misperception, and depending on when you read it, I get accused of bias one way or the other. But, you know, it's just where the debate is at any given time.
In other words, it sounds like you're saying don't be afraid of calling out a conservative or a liberal misperception if in that moment you can't find one from the other side
That's
to
right.
balance it out.
That's right. That's right. Artificial balance does no one any favors.
That's Brendan Nyhan. He, as he said, he's a blogger. We'll hook you up at our website, heroandnow.org, but also a political scientist at the University of Michigan who participated in a series of studies in 2005 and 6 that found that facts don't often change people's misperceptions. Brendan, fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Okay, so what do you think? Patrick McKernan has written us from New Hampshire. He says, I have little patience with conspiracy theories, but there's a reason for public distrust. In the mid-80s, the CIA planted disinformation in the press about Soviet MiGs being sold to Nicaragua. So, Patrick writes, don't conflate terminal cynicism with a stubbornness to accept facts. We'd love to hear from you. Go to hereandnow.org, click on Contact Us to send an email, or scroll down and leave a comment. Meanwhile, last week, Republican presidential hopeful Governor Haley Barbour said the Mississippi schools he went to in the 60s were integrated. Well, as a terrific new book, Freedom Summer, reminds us, Mississippi schools were solidly segregated. We'll hear that story tomorrow. Latest news is next, here and now. The back hallways at Chicago City Hall are buzzing after Mayor Richard Daley's political bombshell that he's not seeking re-election to lead the city his father also ran for 21 years. More than a half dozen aldermen and other city leaders are now said to be mulling mayoral runs, all with an eye on whether White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel will jump into the race. But the country's third largest city has huge financial problems and a legacy. Republicans have been having a field day with the phrase Chicago-style politics ever since Barack Obama went from Chicago to the White House. Ray Long has covered Chicago and Illinois politics for the Chicago Tribune for three decades. So, Ray, first of all, to the reaction. Are people really shocked?
Yes. In fact, this is not just a situation where a few people are raising their eyebrows. This took everybody surprise, especially the timing of it. Nobody thought that if the mayor were even to make such an announcement, that it would come so soon before the November election. A lot of people thought that he would wait and see how the election turned for Democrats. But this could be a signal that some Democrats throughout the country are seeing the tide turn for them. And even though Chicago is a big Democratic city and Daley would have, by all rights, likely have won a seventh term if he had run for it, it's still a time when Daley is under fire.
Well, Tribune columnist John Cass writes today that when he first heard the news, his first thought was, somebody get an injunction to stop the paper shredders. Daley has run the city for as many years as his father did, 21 years. So what is, you know, his legacy?
Well, he is viewed as a builder. He has been big on construction of massive projects, a bigger convention hall called McCormick Place on the lake, a bigger Navy pier and a more a viable Navy pier that is a draw for tourists. And, of course, Millennium Park will probably be his signature move. It's really a grand, expansive area where tourists come from all over the country and pack into it and really have a good time.
Well, you know, and crime has gone down overall, but, you know, we can't help but think of the horrible stories of the inner-city school kids getting caught in crossfire.
Yes, that's true, too, as well as policemen, too. In fact, Daley, at the city council meeting this morning, stood up and said, you know, we need people to come forward to say what they know about the most recent police shooting. Right in front of the family of the police officer, Daley demanded that the people who know what happened come forward. But so often we see in this city that people don't come forward because of fear for themselves.
Well, and what about the thinking that Rahm Emanuel might jump from the White House frying pan into, you know, the fire of Chicago, a record budget shortfall, nearly $655 million in Chicago? You know, Rahm Emanuel is known for his sharp, abrasive style and his temper. Mayors have to be able to go out and squeeze hands.
Well, that's true, but it's also a rough-and-tumble city, and it's a city that appreciates kind of the Grabowski style of politics, hard-hitting, you know, try to get ahead of the other guy, you got to know when to hit and when to kiss and when to shake. And so all of the people out in Chicago would probably see Rahm Emanuel as a viable candidate, but a lot of people are thinking that he doesn't have the strong enough base. Of course, he ran and won a congressional district in Chicago, but there's a lot more of Chicago than just that district.
Yeah. Well, and back to Mayor Daley, who has announced he won't be running again. Just a little more about his legacy. We couldn't help but note what you call the parking meter fiasco, which sounds wild.
Right. He basically sold the rights to parking meters over several years, decades actually, for a chunk of change up forward. And really what happened was that money has been dwindling. The big, massive amount of cash that he got, he's had to tap into to try to write the books.
And the parking meters have pretty much been broken or jammed.
Yeah, a lot of people aren't happy with those either. The prices are going up.
Ray Long, who's covered Illinois politics for the Chicago Tribune, we will be talking again about what the future of Chicago may hold now that Daley says he will not run. Ray, thanks so much.
Good to talk to you, Robin.
Back
Thank
in
you.
30 seconds. Here and now. It's come to our attention that this Sunday marks the 50th anniversary of the speech Democratic presidential candidate John F. Kennedy gave to respond to the claims that his Catholic faith would dominate a presidency, that he'd be a puppet of the Pope. Kennedy spoke before the Greater Houston Ministerial Association.
I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute, where no Catholic prelate would tell the president, should he be Catholic, how to act. And no Protestant minister would tell his parishioners for whom to vote.
Kennedy was, of course, elected the country's first Catholic president. And our next guest says that speech helped set the stage for reducing religious prejudice in politics. And today, when we see so much turmoil over that proposed Islamic Center in New York, for instance, some are wondering, is it time for another speech on the separation of church and state? Dr. Gary Scott Smith chairs the history department at Grove City College. You can read his op-ed about the Kennedy speech at herenow.org, and he joins us. Gary, remind us, what were people saying a Catholic president might do?
Well, they were afraid that he might listen to the Pope instead of his constituency, that he might impose upon them Catholic policies, that he might, in fact, restrict their religious liberties as non-Catholics, as Protestants particularly.
Well, actually, they thought that he might make Catholicism the nation's official religion, forbid criticism of the Catholic Church in print or on the air, restrict Protestant worship.
Absolutely. They were all those things that were expressed in various forums, including sermons and magazine articles and protests against Kennedy's campaign at this time.
And actually, after he was elected, you remind us that some Catholics felt that he actually was way too neutral on religious issues.
Or perhaps even too opposed to the agenda of the Catholic Church on issues such as parochial education, receiving federal funding, or having some type of unofficial ambassador to the Vatican.
Which, in fact, previous presidents had appointed a sort of unofficial ambassador to the Vatican.
They had. We didn't get an official one until the Reagan administration, but as early as FDR and Truman, that had occurred.
Right, and he, JFK, did not.
He did not.
Well, what do you think about what's swirling today, especially as we approach this 50th anniversary of that speech? We have protesters, for instance, of the Islamic Center in New York. Now, we have listeners who say that protests today and fears today about Islam are very different. Here's an unsigned letter I have from a listener saying, you know, Muslims did attack the U.S. They do deny women rights. He worries, he or she worries, that if a Muslim man abuses his wife in the U.S., that will have to be allowed someday under Sharia law unless we're vigilant. Now, this writer acknowledges this is an extreme form of Islam, but that's exactly what they're worried about. Far different from shadowy, unsubstantiated concerns about Catholicism.
Well, there are some parallels. In fact, one could even argue that earlier in history, things were done in the name of Christianity, and particularly Catholic Christianity and the papacy, that were, you know, and it wasn't a radical group. It was the mainstream church that had, in fact, you know, persecuted various groups. That hadn't happened in America. In America, it had been the reverse. To the extent the persecution took place, it had been Protestants limiting the rights and opportunities of Catholics. but we could argue that that's an unfair characterization of Islam by portraying it by its most radical adherents, and it certainly doesn't represent the huge majority of Muslims in the world.
Well, and people do argue that. What do you make, though, of the call by Glenn Beck and Sarah Palin and, you know, thousands on the Mall in Washington to turn back to a country under God? Now, Beck has infamously in the past sort of fueled some of these suspicions about Muslims. He asked the first Muslim ever elected to Congress, this is Keith Ellison, if he was working with our enemies. He made a statement on his show about Muslims who are sitting on their hands and not doing enough about the so-called bad Muslims, saying, you know, when people see their life on the edge, they'll put razor wire up and they will round you up. It will happen. Now, on the Mall, as Taylor Branch points out in an op-ed in the New York Times, Glenn Beck called for people to turn to God, but in their own way. Go to church, go to synagogue, go practice your Muslim faith. So Taylor Branch says this should be welcome.
Well, definitely that should be welcomed. Glenn Beck admits that he has a big mouth, and he's said some things that he regrets, and that he does believe that there is a value in every religious tradition, and we can work together on matters of common concern. I believe strongly that we have strong religious emphasis in our founding, although I think some people, Sarah Palin in particular, probably overstates that.
Just tell us a little bit in the minute we have left. It's not just Sarah Palin. Mitt Romney, others, you know, make the case that the U.S. is a Christian nation, or at the very least a nation of faithful, and they do refer back to the founding fathers. What problems do you see with that?
The basic problem would be a matter of definition. If you mean this is a country that has had a majority of its citizens who throughout most of its history have been Christians or claim to be Christians, that's absolutely true. If you try to claim that we built fundamental Christian commitment into our Constitution, that would be absolutely untrue, because the Constitution doesn't directly say anything about God in the way that the state constitutions, for example, did. In terms of their private faith, a lot of founders were Christians. In terms of their continuing to have established churches on the state level, but they clearly did not want to have a national established church for ideological reasons and for practical ones. What church would you have established if you wanted to have one?
That's Gary Scott Smith. He chairs the history department at Grove City College in Pennsylvania. He's also just written an essay on JFK's speech about faith and politics. We'll link you to that at our website. And just, you know, with so much going on, Gary, we have Muslims ending Ramadan. We have a pastor in Florida threatening to burn the Quran. We have the anniversary of 9/11, and then on Sunday, the anniversary of this speech. Just your thoughts as you reflect on that speech.
It would be great if we had someone to give us a similar kind of speech. I think that would be very difficult for President Obama to do because of the fact that he has already taken a side on the Ground Zero Mosque, and also because so many Americans wrongly perceive him to be overly sympathetic toward Islam, maybe even a Muslim himself. I think if they would look at the speech that he gave on Easter this year, they would get a very different perspective.
Why? Tell us about that speech.
Well, because he strongly affirmed his personal Christian faith and belief in a physical resurrection of Christ. He sets it in the context of, you know, we've celebrated Muslim holidays, we've celebrated Passover, and now I'm going to celebrate the one that relates to my faith, Easter.
But you're saying what? We need another speech that reminds us of the importance of separation of church and state?
I'm saying we need a speech that reminds us that we live in a pluralistic society where people come from different faith traditions and backgrounds, and that we should extend the same opportunities to them that we would like to have ourselves.
Gary Smith, thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Welcome back. There's carbon, radon, borium, radium, and thallium, and 109 others. The elements of the periodic table. We learn a little about them in high school chemistry. For instance, their atomic weight. Hydrogen is 1, oxygen 8. Quick, what's the atomic weight of iodine? 53. But what's generally not taught in the classroom is where all these elements come from. Who discovered them and how? Our next guests took it upon themselves to learn firsthand. It began as a very unusual honeymoon when University of North Texas chemistry professor Jim Marshall and his bride Jenny, a now retired middle school computer teacher, decided to spend their newlywed days in Europe tracking down some of the mines and laboratories where elements were first discovered. They ended up spending the next 12 years finding all 114. They've produced a DVD called Rediscovery of the Elements, and we caught up with them at the studios of KTAR Radio in Phoenix, Arizona. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You know, for some of us, we never thought of them being discovered. They were always there on a table, on the periodic table. But, you know, of course that's not true.
Well, only seven of them have always been there. You know, the ancient metals such as gold and silver and iron and tin and so on. But since then, all the rest of them have been discovered slowly and gradually.
Okay, oxygen. Now, oxygen's always been around, but so what do you mean by it was discovered? Where and by whom?
Well, the thing is, oxygen's been discovered not in one place, but three different places, because when a time is right in science, it happens, and three people independently and separately discovered oxygen, and one was in Sweden, and the other was in Great Britain, and the other was in France, so we had to go to all three places.
So now you have a sample of oxygen, right, because you were devoted to getting samples of everything, so you've got oxygen, along with samples of things that are pretty flammable and volatile. How are you keeping those in your house?
Very carefully. No, they are sealed in a glass ampule, and you wouldn't know that they are really the gas by looking at them. But there are ways of testing that. For example, you could put some of them in liquid nitrogen, and the gas liquefies out. Sometimes you can just put a spark through it and actually see the color of the gas itself as it's irradiated with electricity.
Well, but you've got them, as we said, right there. So, Jenny, I'm reading in an article that you at one point said it makes dusting kind of interesting.
That was so funny. Right before the people came to take a picture of us, I thought, okay, I should dust everything. And I've never had a chemistry class, so I didn't know what would blow up and what wouldn't. So I thought, okay, maybe it would be best not to dust.
Well, you know, and that brings us to another thought. You didn't know which would blow up and which didn't, and yet you followed your husband on these treks to, oh, for instance, Romania, where you were trying to find the birthplace of tellurium, which turned out to be a mine deep in the Transylvanian forest.
Oh, that was spooky. Oh, that was just heavenly, indeed. It was just straight out of a Dracula novel. But we found it. And one thing we found was these people are delighted that here's somebody who comes all the way from America to explore their lands, and they're so proud. And in this particular time, we had a gold mining group that actually took us in their jeep all the way up the top of the mountain to this ancient mine called Fatsibanya, where tellurium had been discovered back 200 years ago.
In 1783. But so Jenny, are you at any point in this Transylvanian forest where you get to this ancient mine? We understand there was all sorts of rotting timbers. Are you at any point thinking, what have I got myself into?
No, it was a great adventure. We climbed this mountain after the jeep delivered us to the place. We climbed up in the muddy hills, and it took us about 20 minutes to get up to the mine. And we nearly cried when we got there because it was fantastic. It had all these ferns and things growing around it. And the actual timbers of the original 200-year-old mine were still there. It was just grand.
Well, Jim, tick through, you know, name me an element and where did you find it?
Oh, gosh. Well, uranium, for example, was discovered in a mine which is on the Germany-Czech border. The ore was found there, but then it was analyzed by a German professor named Klaproth in Berlin. So then we have to go to Berlin where the pharmacy was, because he worked at a pharmacy and did his work in the back of this particular establishment, and it's gone now. But right now there's a plaque. And right next to there is a beautiful little restaurant, Konsum Nussbaum, by the walnut tree, where you can just sit there and eat potato soup and think, 200 years ago, this is where it all happened. It's just lovely.
Well, your travels took you, you know, around the world. In Germany, you found the lab where indium was first isolated. It's now a bathroom.
It is.
chromium and beryllium were discovered, is a children's clothing shop.
Well, it is, yes. A lot of the mines and the buildings exist, and a lot of them don't. Some of the places you go, there's a field. And in the field, there was once a mine where an important element was discovered 200 years ago. And to mark that, we have to locate the precise site with our GPS, and so that somebody can actually go find it again. Otherwise, it would be impossible.
Well, now you've just released a comprehensive interactive DVD. It's called Rediscovery of the Elements. We'll link to it at our website. hundreds of pictures you took during your travels, the details about the elements, the people who discovered them. You both obviously love the science, but it sounds like you love some of the stories behind it. And Jenny, I wanted to ask you about one in particular, radium. It took you to the lab of Madame Curie. Are you there, Jenny?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Good.
She was crying.
Oh.
Give me a second.
Are you serious?
Yes.
What's behind this emotion?
Well, okay, first of all, when we arrived in Paris, I'd never been there before.
Oh.
And we got up the next morning to go to the Madame Curie Museum. And we went to breakfast, and the lady said, all of the taxis are on strike. All of the buses are on strike, and the metro's on strike. You have to walk. So we walked, what was it, about 5 miles. And at that particular time, all of the museums were also on strike. And we knocked on the door, and we said, we've come all the way from the United States. Can we please come in? And Jim handed him his business card, and they let us in. And they said, we will take you on a tour. So we got a private tour of the place. And it was really, really special.
Tell them about the smock.
Well, I guess that's... I'm sorry. I guess that's what I was thinking about, because when we went inside the office, Marie Curie's office, and the lady said, you know, this is her favorite chair, this is her desk, and then she pulled out Marie Curie's smock, and she said, you hold it and let Jim take your picture. And so there's a picture of me holding the smock. It's really cool.
I guess so. Is that about, this, love of your husband's research, or this love of this woman who'd made this extraordinary discovery? Or I'm wondering, too, if, Jenny, part of this is that there's a chemist inside you that's getting out through all of this.
Yes. Marie Curie is my favorite. I've read like 5 books on her. She's my hero.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we hear about just the love and the passion. That's Jim and Jenny Marshall. Jim, a chemistry professor at the University of North Texas in Denton, Texas. His wife, Jenny, a retired computer teacher. But as we had just heard, his avid traveling companion, as they spent 12 years traveling the world to rediscover the birthplaces of each of the 114 elements of the periodic table. Jim, Jenny, thank you both so much.
You're welcome. You're welcome. We've really enjoyed it.
There's antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium, ruthenium, uranium, europium, zirconium, lutetium, vanadium, and lanthanum, and osmium, and astatine, and radium, and gold, protactinium, and indium, and gallium.